Chapter 15. A Sudden Zigzag. How came the emotion-laden final act? Millions of Russians were under arms. Great masses of French plowmen and mustachioed vine growers, at this time 47% of the French were still farmers, streamed to the railway stations, forming a great river of olive drab. To the cheers of millions they entrained in coaches daubed with "On to Berlin." In Vienna, throngs roared "Death to Serbia," and the Germans of Berlin roared their anthem with no less ebullience. Only Great Britain, among the great powers of Europe, still wavered in official indecision. The government of Herbert Henry Asquith was profoundly divided over whether to join the revanchists of France and the Panslavist imperialists of Russia or to maintain Britain's splendid isolation and cultivate its far-flung empire. In the end, the British leadership, blind in its lordly arrogance, would let its short-term resentments over Germany's burgeoning economic power prevail over its long-term interests in checking the growth of the colossus which stretched from Warsaw to Vladivostok. Perhaps the key issue for the British leadership was its consternation at the expansion of the German navy and merchant fleet. This fear was magnified by Kaiser Wilhelm's tendency to bluster, but in reality his bark was worse than his bite. Britain's leaders might have learned this from the American political manager and wirepuller, Colonel Edward Mandel House, Woodrow Wilson's Eminence Grice, who talked to Wilhelm while on a fact-finding mission in Europe at Wilson's behest in June 1914. House, certainly no Germanophile, reported that the Kaiser had impressed on him with great urgency that he was building his great fleet not to oppose England, but to increase German prestige on the high seas, as well as to promote German commerce. Wilhelm stated, "I want peace, because the interests of Germany require it. Germany was poor, but now she is in the process of becoming rich, and a few years of peace will make her quite rich." Great Britain's foreign minister, when communicated these sentiments by House, was impressed by them. Grey admitted to House that the Germans need to maintain a navy that is proportionate to the importance of their commerce and big enough to defend themselves against a combined attack by the Russian and French fleets. House doubtless also told the British diplomat of Wilhelm's desire to end his naval construction program after those ships under construction or already planned were built. In the eyes of many Britishers, however, each German ship completed was one too many. Nothing struck at the British sense of self-esteem and self-preservation more acutely than any perceived threat to British domination of the world's oceans. Wilhelm hadn't the sensitivity and tact to recognize that, as a far more clever player of the diplomatic game, Adolf Hitler, did in 1935 when he conceded British naval superiority vis-à-vis Germany. The traditional disregard of the average Briton for affairs on the continent also weighed against the Germans. Magnificently aloof, they paid little heed to the implications of the assassination in Sarajevo, which, as House brutally put it, aroused in Britain no more stir than a tenor singing in the middle of a boiler shop. In the end, it all came down to the hoary balance of power game, by which Britain's rulers had promoted a divided Europe, no matter what the cost to the West, for three centuries. The clever, urbane, and slippery Grey drawled at a cabinet meeting as the Sarajevo crisis heated to a boil, "That would be a stroke of luck, having the Germans and Slavs go at each other." Prudently, he had added, "The game could become dangerous." A few voices warned of the dangers of the growth of the Tsarist superstate. House had pointed out the danger of a too powerful Russia, as well as Germany's value as a buffer. The liberal leader, John Morley, one of Britain's most upright ministers, was of like mind. He asked, "What would happen if Russia should be victorious in the long run? Have you ever thought about that? If Germany is defeated and Austria is defeated, it will not be England and France that will occupy the first place in Europe. It will be Russia. Will Western civilization get any advantage out of that?" Stalin would finally answer that question in 1945. Despite the case for non-intervention, the Asquith government was dominated by a fear of offending the regimes of France and Russia. Grey neglected to communicate with the Germans to the end of negotiating peace because, in his words, "I prefer to refrain from sending any official communication, written or verbal, for Fear of offending the French and the Russians, should either of them get wind of the matter. He said it again to his cabinet, England must necessarily act with prudence for fear of offending the feelings of France and Russia. For fear of offending the members of a defensive alliance in which Great Britain was unquestionably the key member, 947,000 men of the British Isles would go to their deaths. Kaiser Wilhelm's last, chimeric hopes for peace, with England as with Russia, came down to the reigning monarch. In Britain it was George V, Wilhelm's cousin, scion of a royal family not noted for its powers of intellect. George was a decorous mediocrity, timorous and a bit on the deceitful side, a fragile hope to take a stand for peace, particularly in a nation in which the powers of the sovereign were so carefully circumscribed. We have noted the fiasco of George V's promise to Wilhelm's younger brother, Prince Henry, stating quite plainly that Great Britain would observe neutrality. Although Wilhelm was beside himself with joy when he received the news, "I have the word of a king," Churchill, as we have seen, already had the fleet steaming for the Channel. On July 29, 1914, Grey sent for Germany's ambassador, Prince Lichnowsky, to shake him with this message. A European catastrophe is to be feared from one day to the next. If the conflict remains limited to one between Austria and Russia, England will be able to stand aside. If not, England will no longer be in a position to remain neutral indefinitely. He continued, "It is far from my thought to express a threat. I simply wish to spare you a deception and to avoid, on my part, the reproach of having been lacking in sincerity." For all Grey's protestations of sincerity, he had sent messages to all the embassies informing them of the virtual end of British neutrality even before receiving Lichnowsky. That evening Asquith told his wife that he had dispatched telegrams to all parts of the empire, informing the governments and administrations to prepare for war. Wickham Steed, editor of the Times, returned to his office from a confidential cabinet interview with the words "everything is lost" on his lips. For the former Prime Minister, Arthur James Balfour, the sight of passers-by promenading down Cockspur Street was a bitter one. "War is rushing down upon them," he said to himself. Wilhelm II received Lichnowsky's report of his conversation with Grey with outrage, and unleashed a series of rich imprecations against perfidious Albion. He quickly recovered his equilibrium, however, and began to study what measures remained to keep the peace. He knew of Russia's ongoing mobilization, but Poincaré's maneuverings were as yet a secret. His last card remained the unlikely intervention of his cousin, George V. That sovereign was sleeping when his prime minister, Asquith, asked to be received. The king, once roused, threw on his dressing gown and applied himself to replying to his cousin's plea for neutrality in terms with which his ministers could agree. The text of the telegram bore a last hope for peace. The German ambassador reported to Berlin that Grey had promised not to intervene if Germany did not attack France, and asked for a German statement on that matter. Lichnowsky informed his government that he had promised that to Grey, as he had been authorized, and that Grey would communicate the statement to the cabinet. A telegram is of value only when it is received, however. Lichnowsky was only able to send it from London on the morning of August 1, after a 10-hour delay, and it arrived in Berlin another 5 hours later. The wasted 15 hours seem almost certainly accounted for by the delaying tactics of the anti-German faction in the Asquith government and in the British establishment. Nevertheless, when the news finally arrived, it seemed a providential opportunity to stave off war. Ominously enough, however, when news of the British government's apparent reversal of policy was telegraphed to the British ambassador in Paris, Sir Francis Bertie, the ambassador failed to inform the French government. Bertie, a supporter of Poincaré's policies, was in open rebellion against his government. As the hours wore on, and the telegram remained undelivered, the British government made a sudden zigzag in its course, as it had done so often in the past. This time it was George V, last repository of the tenuous hopes for peace in Europe, who was thrown overboard.